Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. My name is Audrey, and I will be your weekly host, or today's host, for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you all for joining us. So today, our special guest speaker is Arlene Salmon, and someone who really embodies today's theme of encountering open doors on the path of service. So here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Amita Martin, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into a Q&A and circle of sharing, where we invite all of your reflections and questions. Amita, thanks for joining us. Do you have any thoughts about today's conversation?
Thank you very much. No, I'm just so thrilled and to be moderating today's call. I am so inspired by Arlene's story. She's been a nurse practitioner in maternal fetal medicine for over 30 years now, and her work in saving women and newborns is mind-blowing. It is truly inspiring. And so thank you very much for asking me to moderate this call today with this very inspirational woman. So although, you know, we stated that Arlene's call in this area in Tibet started with her meeting with Dalai Lama in 1997, actually Arlene has been in service and service to others for quite a bit longer than that, and her history of service actually started in the 1980s. So, Arlene, can you take us to the beginning on how you began your journey into service and how that led to your meeting with the Dalai Lama?
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on this call this morning, and listening to you, Amita, I'm just like, I think I've shared with Amita, I really feel I'm a conduit and not so much a leader on this path. I guess I just keep saying yes. And so my journey really began in the early 80s when I lived in West Virginia, and my ex-husband was studying to be an anesthesiologist, and we were invited by a group called Enterplast, who's now called Research, and they were one of the first medical teams that went to other countries to do cleft lip and palate surgery. And I was very, very fortunate my first trip to go with Dr. Donald Lobb, who was the chief of plastic surgery from Stanford, and some very, you know, amazing and famous plastic surgeons at their time in reconstructive surgery. And I remember we went to Honduras, and we arrived, and there were just a sea of children and families that had walked for days to get there to have an opportunity to have their cleft lip or palate or burns or whatever repaired. And I just remember thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I don't know, you know, if we'll have enough time to do all these cases. And I was so impressed that every person on the team, we worked from probably 6 in the morning till 10 or 11 o'clock at night, I mean, with the goal that we would get through the hundreds of people waiting. And by the end of it, I think every single one of us felt so deeply touched and inspired by the people themselves, and that we left after 2 weeks realizing that we had received far more than we could have ever given back to them, just their confidence in us and their compassion towards us and their own stories of courage and survival and deep devotion and love to their children, that they would walk days, you know, to get this surgery. So it taught me, really, it gave a gift to me, I would say, and knowing that that's what I wanted to do with my life, that it was far bigger than, I'm not going to say just being a nurse, because I've had an incredible nursing career, but that I wanted to serve in even a bigger arena than just my job at the university. Rather, I was also working on a Navajo Indian reservation, but I just felt like the world was beyond that, that my neighborhood was global, I suppose. So that I worked with Enerplas for over 12 years, and it was really my journey with Enerplas that led me to meet His Holiness the Dalai Lama in India, because there were several Tibetan children, refugee children, that had cleft lips and palates. And then there was a letter that came from the Ministry of Health in India to Enerplas, and then they asked me to go over and take some surgeons with me to take care of the children there.
So how did this lead then to your visit with His Holiness?
Well, there were four of us that arrived, but prior to my departure of going to India, someone, I was living in Salt Lake City, told me that the Dalai Lama's niece, his eldest sister's daughter, was living in Salt Lake City. And so I contacted her, and then her husband's cousin actually was the doctor that ran the hospital in Dharamsala. So not only were we invited by the Ministry of Health, but I was actually able to reach out directly to the hospital director, and who arranged our visit. And upon our arrival, he asked us if we would like to have a private audience with His Holiness. And of course, none of us said no. I mean, we were so excited. And I remember the night before, my friend Bill is he's part Chinese and part Irish. And he was like, oh, what am I going to ask His Holiness? And then Paolo, he's an Italian plastic surgeon. And he said, I want to ask His Holiness why that there's these acid burns. How could anybody throw acid on a young bride in Bangladesh? Because when that happens, it destroys their life. So Paolo was seeking an answer, and they asked me, what are you going to ask His Holiness? And I said, I'm going to ask how I can help. So the next day we waited in the waiting room, and we were brought in to meet with His Holiness, and we had about 2 hours. And it was very informal. I mean, it was like we were sitting in his living room chatting, and we showed him the pictures of the before and after of the children, and he talked to Paolo about karma and you know, that could be something playing out with these burns. And then he said to me, I know your background is in maternal child health. I want you to go to Tibet and help the women and children. My mother had 16 children, and half of them died under the age of 5. And I thought, oh, okay. And then we all left. We operated on a few children, and we left, and Bill had the commitment to go back to Dharamsala, and Paolo and I decided that we would do our best to go to Tibet. But at that time, Tibet was closed, and even to get, it seemed daunting to think, how are we going to get invited to go there? But I looked around, and I found a doctor that was from the Bay Area, actually, who was doing a project there, contacted her. She gave me a number of a doctor that spoke English in Lhasa, and contacted Dr. Paulden. And then he made arrangements for us to get permission as an outside medical team to come to Lhasa to operate on children with cleft lips and palates. And everybody said before we went, number one, you're never going to get permission. And number two, there's no children with cleft lips and palates there. And we did get permission, and we arrived there, and it seemed like everywhere we went, like we would get in a taxi, there would be a child begging that had a cleft lip, or we'd go for a walk, and we met a monk with a cleft lip. And so it's just like people came out of the woodwork. And then we got one monk who was, I'd say, in his 20s, to agree to come for surgery, and it was much easier because he was an adult than to try to put a child to sleep. And so that was the first opportunity that we had to work in Lhasa. And then while I was there, I heard so many stories about women dying in childbirth. And it's a fascinating phenomena, but in places like, especially Tibet, it's like news got out very quickly, even though I didn't say a word, that I had background in high-risk obstetrics. And then people just literally came to my hotel room.
Wow. You know, one of the things that we discussed and that I had no idea about was the cultural views around childbirth in Tibet. And women there, basically go out and have babies on their own. They don't have any assistance from midwives or anyone else to help them in their birthing process. So can you talk to us about what you found out about the childbirth process in Tibet?
Yes, I find it quite fascinating because we, all Westerners, I think we have an assumption that there's usually what we call traditional birth attendants in many cultures. And now I work in many different places around the world, and actually that myth is not true. There's many cultures, Tibet being one of them. And so in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a concept of pollution around the blood of childbirth and menses, but more around childbirth. And so women during childbirth always gave birth outside of the home, and usually in the animal shed where there was hay and it was dirty, and it made sense if you're going to pollute something to go pollute something that's already dirty. And they would go out alone like an animal because that's just historically how it was. And they didn't ever think about delivering in the hearth of the home where the fire was, because this pollution would offend the spirits of the home, and then these spirits could cause harm to the family or give seizures to the child or make the mother have postpartum hemorrhage, or the cord would wrap around the neck. There were lots of superstitions around that. And so when we first went, we took cultural anthropologists that were specialists in Tibetan medicine and Tibetan Buddhism. And we did cultural surveys to understand the spiritual and cultural beliefs. And then understanding that belief, we then came up with an idea with the community. If we were to design a clean birth kit that had a plastic sheet, a clean razor blade, a clean string, gloves, soap, and all of these things, what if we could deliver in the home where it was warm and people were around, and then we could contain the pollution and then go and bury it or burn it? And then we also took the birth kits and had them blessed by the local lamas. So then everybody thought, oh, that works. That totally will work. So that's how we started with birth kits, and then first getting people to deliver in the home. And then at that time, the local government was starting to have birthing centers. They actually were pretty rough looking when we started working there. So we also worked to upgrade these birthing centers. And women would not go there because they would not want to deliver with a stranger, because there was a belief that if a stranger attended your birth, they could bring hungry ghosts on their back, and the hungry ghost could jump into the baby and make the baby sick. So then we said, okay, if we train a health worker in your community that you know, and then we take them and they get the training and they have all the equipment to be a birthing attendant, they will no longer be a stranger. And then you also, if you go to them early in your pregnancy, then you'll know them, they'll take care of you, and all the pollution can be left behind in the birthing center, and you have somebody that can really take care of you. So that's how the next hurdle we got over. So we just really looked at every challenge or every superstition or as an opportunity, and we adapted to their culture instead of asking them to adapt to ours. And so it was the same thing around pollution. That's why they used a dirty knife to cut the cord. So we said, okay, well, if you use this clean razor blade, it doesn't have any pollution on it, and we can also bury it or burn it, then you need to use this, because if you use your dirty knife, you are giving pollution to the baby and you're getting pollution on your knife. So then they're like, oh yeah, that sounds perfect. So it's just been my favorite part of the project is navigating those opportunities and adapting to their culture instead of them adapting to ours.
Wow, that's an amazing story. So yeah, I can't even conceive of any woman, or even after going through medical school and learning everything, I couldn't even imagine trying to do the birthing process on my own and then cutting the cord and delivering the placenta. So how are these women that didn't know anything about the birthing process, how could they even go out into their own shed and deliver a baby on their own and know what to do?
They didn't know what to do. I mean, that was a big part of the problem, is that they just had the concept that, well, animals do that, and they either survive or not. And sometimes, like, a mother-in-law or a sister-in-law would come and give them tea or help with cutting the cord, but again, with a dirty knife. I mean, so they, it was just a matter of, this is what your mother did, and that's what they did for generations, and that's the way we're going to do it. And this is not indifferent. I mean, it's the same process that goes on where I worked in Ecuador with the Achuars in the Amazon jungle. Many places in Nepal where we're working, it's the same story. And this recent trip, asking women now, how do they feel? Why do they go to a clean birthing center? And they all had the same answer, because the nurses are kind and I feel safe. And, they did go into childbirth with a lot of trepidation. They knew they would be facing death or their child, but in a way, it was accepted as, like, okay, if I die, that's part of my karma, that I would die or that my child would die. So teaching them, like, if your baby's not breathing, and not to just set the baby aside, but to try to resuscitate and give a breath to the baby, was such a new concept. I mean, they thought it was magic when we had a baby that didn't breathe and we could just do some basic things and get them to breathe. It was just like unheard of. Like, that's magic. And then it just took on like wildfire, of course, because everybody wants to save their baby or the mom. And so it's really has been about driving systemic behavior change that saves lives now and in future generations, because they won't go back. I mean, that's one thing I remembered was so profound for me, was out one night when I was staying out on the Tibetan Plateau, and we worked in places that was about 15,000 feet, just wide, expansive plateau with these magic mountains and then clouds that looked like you could touch them, and wild horses and yaks and fires burning and realizing, like, this is never going to be the same. This ripple effect will now take hold. They will never go back to delivering that way again. Wow. I mean, that was like, hit me like something I never really realized before, of like how one person, one thought has that ripple effect and can touch thousands of lives, hundreds of thousands of lives, future generations. So it was really something for me to actually witness within myself, like, wow, this is not going to be the same ever.
And that's so inspiring. So how did the men in the villages and the families, how did they react to this?
Oh, that it was so, it's been really beautiful. The grandfathers and the husbands in Tibet were so curious and so wanting to learn everything as well, although they usually did not at that time attend births, but they became very engaged in the process of making sure that the woman did go to where there was a birth attendant. And some of the birth attendants in Tibet actually were men, but they were very much a driving force behind the change. Because they didn't want their wife to die, and they certainly didn't want their children to die. So although, no one really understood the whole birthing process and, you know, physiologically and anatomically, to be honest with you. But getting them engaged was very simple because they had such a curiosity around it. So they became like the helpers, making sure that the woman got the care that she needed, not so much being the one that attended it. And in Nepal, we are actually seeing now the men in the community are the driving force to have birthing centers in their communities. They are donating their own land. They're collecting money from all community members, building the birthing centers, and then have made commitments that all women within their communities will be taken and delivered in the birthing centers. And the men now are accompanying their wives and witnessing the births. So it's like phenomenal change.
That is, I mean, there's so many places that you would think that maybe men would be obstructionists in this process. So that's amazing to see how you've changed the entire culture of these communities.
Well, in fact, when I started working more in Nepal, because the husbands were more engaged actually in Tibet, in Nepal, when I very first started, and we were meeting with about 70 of the health post administrative team, which were mostly men, I'd say 80% men. I posed a question that actually it just seemed like it was channeled to me. I had not planned this at all, but it was one of those organic moments where I trusted my intuition. And I said, how many of you have a mother? And they were looking at me like, oh my gosh, what is she saying? That's a crazy question. So I raised my hand and I said, I want you all to imagine for one moment, close your eyes and imagine your life today if your mother had died in childbirth. Moment of silence. Tears. I said, even if your father remarried, that woman would not be your mother, probably would not treat you like her only child. And if your mother died, then you probably would be raised by other family members. You wouldn't have that nurturing and that kind of love. It would, your whole life would be different. And the men came up to me afterwards and said, we want to take a stand and we want to be a part of the solution and not part of the problem. because they said to me, we realize we have been part of the problem, not always helping our wives to get to a birthing center or putting money aside to make that a priority or giving her the loving support and care that she needs. And I said, if your wife dies, she's the mother of your child. If you beat your wife, it's like beating the mother of your child. It's like having your mom beat in front of you. It was like a pin, you could hear a pin drop. And it just, that was enough to change their attitude.
That's a really powerful image. I mean, I can almost just see the room and you talking to these men and, like you said, being pin silent as they're realizing, the impact of your words.
Yeah. And then we broke up into, focus groups, and it was all about what are the obstacles for women getting access and care and how to solve those solutions. And every single group independently came up with the things that men needed to do to make this shift happen. And literally, the men in these communities have been the ones that donated their land, built the birthing centers, and have taken a stand. All women in our community will have birth within a birthing center with a midwife.
Now, one of the parts that was so inspiring about reading your story was how you've actually changed outcomes. We all love the idea of being able to do good things, but you've truly made such a huge difference. Can you give us statistics before of what maternal and infant mortality were? And now, after just the initiation of your program, how things have changed?
And I am actually going to pull up my report so that I give you accurate numbers. We know that since we started working in two of the districts where we work, which is Bogloon and Dolpa, which both are rural districts in Nepal, and very mountainous, and we mostly, that's where we work. And the same happened in Tibet, is what we saw, that when we started in Tibet, about one woman out of 100 would die in childbirth, and 10, one out of 10 newborn babies. And so when we started our program, after 5 years in the districts, actually counties we worked in, Tibet, we had zero maternal mortality, and newborn dropped from 10 to 3%. And it has pretty much stayed that way because I'm in touch with my Tibetan staff that took over the project after we had to leave. And so in Bogloon district in Nepal, the number of neonatal deaths from 2010 dropped from 300 to zero last year. And the number of maternal deaths went from average 30 a year to zero the last 2 years.
That is so phenomenal. I mean, there are so many NGOs operating out there, but, they can't claim the success that you've been able to have in these remote areas, and like you said, saving the mother and saving these newborns. I'm just so totally inspired by your commitment.
I think it goes to that saying, you teach a man to fish and they can feed themselves. Is that we really, everything we do is to empower and to give the skills to the local people, and they do it. I mean, I'm not there doing it. They are. They take full responsibility of these outcomes.
But you were able to incorporate their own cultural views and come to a way that that they're able to empower themselves. And like you said, it wasn't imposing Western tradition and, you know, doing more harm in these areas. That's what's so inspiring about it.
Well, and to be honest with you, Amita, I mean, I had I think my experience with Interplast, it taught me a lot of things. And one thing I knew for sure is that in global health in general, in the past, we've gone in and wanted this is how we're going to do it our way. We haven't always taken the time and effort to build infrastructure within the community, for the community, by the community, and to understand beliefs and practices that actually need to be adjusted. You know, instead of wiped out, we just need to adjust to them. And I think that is a different way of doing global health. And it takes, I think it's a slower process, but I think it's more sustainable and replicable in the end. It's not like we're going to drop in and do something and then leave. It really is a commitment to the behavior change happening and giving them the tools to change their behavior and the love and respect and the support and respect. And I think that's what's, to me, is very unique about One Heart, is that we have made that kind of a commitment wherever we work.
Well, and then that was shown or amplified when you were asked to leave Tibet in 2008 during the Chinese uprising. And they've continued to follow these practices and continued to have the success, like you said, because you worked within the community and to make it self-sustaining.
Yep.
So can you tell us a little bit about what happened? I know you've said that March 14, 2008 was such an important day for you. Can you tell us a bit about that and the uprising?
Yeah, I think I shared with you, Amita, yesterday about when prior years before I was going to work in Tibet, that I took refuge with a very senior and very well-respected Tibetan Rinpoche who had been a meditator for 30 years in a cave. And it was his first time to come to the U.S. to teach and to give refuge to students. And he came with one of his students who was the translator. And during that process of taking your vows as a bodhisattva, taking refuge, the translator got up off his cushion and came over only to me and made a gesture of, even if a Chinese soldier holds a gun to your head, you will take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And of course I said yes. I mean, I also thought, that's never going to happen. So flash forward, I mean, at least, you know, almost like 20 years later, and the day of the uprising, it was made public that I was a CNN hero, and that was going to be live on the internet, and we were going to celebrate. And there had been some minor incidents during that week because it's March 10th is when China invaded Tibet, so always around that time it's quite sensitive, and this is the year of the Olympics, and so we were all worried something was going to happen. And there were some little scuttles that happened at several monasteries earlier in the week. And then that Friday, the 14th, my staff, we were all going to gather, and my three daughters that I took care of, we were going to all get together and celebrate. the CNN hero thing. And around noon, I went out for a meeting. And I usually didn't go off by myself when I was working. And my driver dropped me off. And I just looked around, and I thought something was a bit off. And I went into a restaurant. And when I went to leave, I could see that there was some demonstrations. It looked like demonstrations happening. And then I saw cars being turned over and set on fire and people running. And I knew that there were a lot of military tanks, because when I arrived in February, we saw 30 or 40 tanks coming into the city. So it was very clear that an uprising was in motion. And I went back in the restaurant and I called the U.S. Embassy. I was the first person to call in and ask, what do I do? You know, can somebody come and get me? Because now I'm surrounded by danger. And they're like, well, nobody can come get you. We don't have an embassy there. We can call your family. And they gave me instructions, you know, stay away from the windows, make sure you have water and all of these things. And after 3 or 4 hours of, you know, you could hear explosions and gunfire and there was smoke in the streets, I just decided I needed to get out of that restaurant because it was, actually I was in harm's way there. And I don't know where I got the courage to walk out that door, but I did. And once I walked out, there was no way to go back. And I just kept going. I got to a hotel where I knew there were other foreigners and banged on the door and they let me in. So then maybe it was at least 6 hours before the Chinese government actually sent in the tanks and the army to stop the riots. They just let it escalate. And all the shops that were Chinese were broken into. Everything was thrown in the streets. There were fires everywhere. And then that evening, the tanks rolled in, and there was, I'm sure, tear gas, but also shootings and things going on. And, you know, for the next 36 hours, that's pretty much you're wondering, you know, what is happening? Because then it was martial law, and trying to stay in touch with my staff and my daughters and, you know, people that you know, and the phone was going down and internet sometimes off and on. And then the next day the police came and they wanted everyone, all the foreigners, to leave the hotel. And I asked to be taken back to my office. And I was put in a police car and driven to my office, where I then was even more in harm's way because we were surrounded by military, and it had been an area that a lot of the riots earlier had taken over this Muslim area and Chinese. So there were a lot of attacks on the Muslim shops as well. And then the next 24 hours also, you know, listening to gunfire and explosions all night. And then one of my Tibetan staff that was there, she said, let's go and go to your apartment and get your stuff. And I said, well, there's soldiers out there. I don't really think that they're going to let us. It's martial law. So she went out and spoke to the Chinese soldiers, and they said, okay, sure, you can go, but we're not going to protect you. So the two of us now went out on abandoned streets to go get my passport and stuff at my apartment. And we caught a Chinese soldier off guard who was interrogating Tibetan family. And so they just turned and held us at gunpoint. And I remember in that moment looking at this young soldier, and I had absolutely zero fear. And I just thought to myself, I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And he put his gun down and apologized and let me go get my things. And then we came back. We had to go back through these fires and everything thrown in the streets and chaos. And then we were held by a tank so that we could not leave, and forced to witness Tibetans being arrested and beaten in front of us. Until the police officer thought that that was, we'd seen enough, basically, and then put me in a car and said, see what the Dalai Lama has done. And then eventually we were able to get outside of the city and go out and stay close to the airport and leave. That's pretty remarkable.
I know. It's like watching a movie, like you're just like an observer to something going on. And
yeah.
But then there was also this voice that kept saying to me, everything is in divine order and you don't need to know what it is right now. Just trust.
Mm-hmm.
And the voice was like, you can't make sense of this. How could you?
Well, I guess the last thing I'm going to say before we open it up to questions, I think, is, one of the most moving things that you said to me was that you don't believe anything happens by accident. And as you told me your story, there was so much perfect convergence of things and how it happened. And as we kind of relate back to our theme, that on the path to service, all doors will open for you. And it just seems like this was your path from, at least the 80s on and probably your entire life, because it all just kind of came together for you. Do you feel like this was your path, that this was what you were meant to do?
Oh, absolutely. And it's really unstoppable because, as you know, Amita, that after the uprising, we were not allowed to continue to work in Tibet. And I had to leave behind my staff, my daughters, sell my apartment. I left everything. I literally left there with nothing, and most of all left behind, I felt my heart and soul, and I just thought, there's no way I could ever put myself through this again. I'm done. But I did meet with His Holiness, and I met with also my staff in Tibet. They said, never give up, and please, we beg of you to take what you learned here from us and pay it forward. And at that time I thought, no way, I'm not going to start this all over. It's just so painful. And I did start it all over. And it's growing by leaps and bounds and has this beautiful life force in Nepal, far beyond what I could have done at that time in Tibet. And the Tibetans took over the project and just recently won the Charity of the Award, of the Year Award. So they're thriving. And if you can just get out of your own way sometimes, and it's all about trust and really trusting the higher force that it is all in divine order. And I don't need to know what it is, but to be willing to serve. And at times, if you need to be willing not to. But I did start it over, and I did surrender, which what I learned is actually a position of great strength and not weakness. And then I, last year was in the earthquake in Nepal and went back to China and witnessed the 8.4 earthquake in Shanghai. And so some reason I'm supposed to really learn or witness impermanence.
That's so powerful, Arlene. Thank you so much for these amazing stories. And I have so many questions, Arlene, from all that you shared. I'm curious, as I'm listening to you speak, there's this really kind of sense that, in a way, that it's not
it's not that you're not the actor in a way, that you're kind of just, you know, in the right place, the right time with the right intention and just kind of doing whatever is in that divine order as you spoke about. And I was reading in your in the bio about you on the website about when you first, the first boy you met who had a cleft lip, and the 5-year-old Nicholas in Chile, and how you had hosted him and several other children as they went through their surgeries. I'm curious, how, can you share a bit about your experience with Nicholas and how you learned to never accept no as an answer on that path of service?
Wow, that's a long time ago, but thank you for reminding me of him. He was a boy that I met in Chile that actually had a cleft face. So the cleft went through his mouth, but all the way through his face. So it wasn't.
And can you
all
describe
open.
Maybe what a cleft lip is, or what that might mean for those of us on the call who might not know?
So actually, when you're developing as an embryo, your face comes together as two halves that meet in the middle. It doesn't happen the other way, where you all happens at once. It forms as two halves that come together. And so something happens. It can be genetic or environmental, or we don't know, some medications that interfere at some point in time when that is occurring. And then if it's the lip or the palate, or it can be a cleft through the whole face, it gets disrupted. And so instead of coming together as two halves, there's a split. That half doesn't come is not complete. And Nicholas had some surgeries in Chile, but needed to have more craniofacial surgery because they needed to actually move the orbits of his eyes closer together and the other parts of the clefts in his face that were still wide apart. And they didn't have that type of surgery or the equipment in Chile at that time. And so when we met him, I came back and I was working for a pediatric craniofacial surgery. And I told him about the case, and he said, oh, you know, I'll operate on him for free. And then if you can get the hospital to take care of him for free, and then we'll find somebody that will take care of the family to bring him here. And so I did. I went to the hospital directors and, you know, told them the story and said, you know, can we please bring him here? And I raised the money to get the family there. I found a family that would take him in. And, you know, they would have to take him for a while because these surgeries are done many times in stages. And I just remember Nicholas, you know, who as a little boy, you know, I think at the time he was 5 or 6 years old, I mean, saying to me, you know, do I look like a monster?
Aww.
And just being able to say, no, you're so handsome. And then seeing his face after these surgeries, you know, watching him go through those changes. I mean, obviously he was never going to look totally normal, but just the love that his parents had and watching him go through that and seeing the confidence and watching the transition, you know, really through love and care and expert medical care. And, you know, as far as I know, I mean, he's thriving and doing well and has grown up to be a very kind and compassionate young man.
Wow, that's beautiful. And you ended up doing this with several children during your time in Chile all those years ago. Was that really that long ago?
Right. I actually met another girl with a similar story from Ecuador. And actually Nicholas ended up living with me during that time. And then this other girl, Katrina, who was older, that we brought, she also needed to have hand surgery and hand and foot and the craniofacial. And then she stayed with a family that I'm still very close to, and it changed her children's lives because they were about the same age and everybody had to take care of her. And I still know the daughters, and recently was talking to one of them about what that was like for her to have Katrina living with them. So it can be challenging, but it's also you get so much more than you could ever give.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, you've probably seen so many instances of that. Are there any that come to mind? Any particularly memorable, patients that you've had, or, experiences where you've really witnessed that a shift in yourself or in them?
Well, I have three girls that have been in my life from Tibet. I met the oldest one, who was, I think, 9 at the time, and begging on the street. And she had a little baby that the family, I learned later, had found in the garbage. And she was in rags. The baby was in rags. The baby was in an old box, and she was feeding it Coke in this dirty bottle, and she was eating some noodles out of the garbage. And I saw her, and I stopped to talk to her and gave her money. And then I thought, that's not enough. This has to end right now. I went back to my office and got one of my staff so I could have a further conversation in Tibetan. And when I got back, there were two other little girls that were her sisters and the mom. I put them all in the car, took them back to my office, which was in a really nice hotel. And here I come in with these little beggars, in rags. I'm sure the hotel staff was thinking, what in the world is she going to do now? And brought them out into the backyard and the patio and brought whatever they wanted to eat and kind of told them, got the story that they were very poor farmers from another area and this was their only means to make money, was to put the girls on the street to beg, and they'd found the baby in the trash. And so I said, this ends today. These girls are going to go to school. They're going to make something of their life. And this begging is stopping right now, the cycle. And we threw the girls, we didn't throw them, we put them in the bath. And the water was completely black. And they got out. I think it's the first time they ever had a bath, and washed their hair. And then my staff went out and got them these dresses. All that got the same dresses, all that got the same shoes, a little denim jacket, and it was like a railroad captain's hat or something. And I remember the girls afterwards twirling around in my bedroom and saying, do we still look like beggars? And I said, no, you're my three little princesses. And, oh, my gosh, that has been another life lesson and a struggle and filled with courage and tears and love and joy. And the two girls just graduated from high school and are headed to college. And wow. the older of the three is married and has two children. And
these are the three daughters you mentioned mm-hmm. that you
mentioned. Yeah, these are my three girls, yeah. And I remember when I first met them that there was a tour bus with some people, and one of the people on the bus was a minister from a church. And she asked the girls, to tell a little of their life and who I was. And they said, oh, well, she's our angel. And they told, and then I watched them because they would, at the beginning, if other beggars tried to get money from me, they would fight with them. They would push them away and start arguing. And I said to them, you don't have to defend, everything you need, you'll have no matter what. And now each one of you are going to give money to beggars. Mm-hmm. And so I started giving them money every day that they had to give away so that they knew that they had more than enough. And then I remember one day after lunch, there was extra food. They each got three packages of food, which I thought they were taking to their parents. And they said, no, we want to give this away to other bakers.
Wow.
What a powerful way to teach them abundance. You know, mm-hmm. three kids that were just so born into scarcity. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you took this lesson and you taught them abundance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they learned it.
So if
and,
the girls...
Yeah, go ahead.
Are the girls, they're all still in Tibet, right?
They're all in Tibet, and the two that finished high school will be applying to go to university. So they'll probably, one may end up going to the university in Lhasa or just outside of Lhasa. I'm not sure if one will end up in mainland China. I mean, once they go to school there, I'm going to have them apply to see if I can get them to go over here. But it's very difficult for them to get a visa to leave Tibet.
So you're not able to see them while they're in Tibet?
The only way I can see them is to meet them in mainland China. I can go to mainland China, so I can meet them there, which I've done.
They probably miss you.
Yeah. we miss each other. I Skype them, and they remember, I mean, because I've known them now 12 years, and they remember every little, you know, song that we ever sang, and we always said to each other, and I would put my fingers together, and I would say, I miss you this much, like your two fingers together, and then it would just go as far out into infinity as possible. they still say that to me, and I've learned to say it in Tibetan, so it's very cute.
And how, like, what, I'm just curious, you know, I mean, I live in, you know, a city, and there's homeless people and people asking for money and things, you know, at a lot of corners where I turn. And I've noticed, you know, sometimes my heart tightens or constricts around that, like, oh, I don't have the time, or I don't, you know, like, I don't have what you want or whatever it is. And I'm curious, listening to you share this story, in a way, it's like you have no fear of what could come down the road, you know, and like no sense of scarcity in a way. And I'm curious, what gives you that expansiveness to take the time to engage in that way? Because I'm sure there's no shortage of things that you had to do that day when you met those three girls.
Mm-hmm.
How did you just, you know, what gives you that the sense of, you know, wanting to engage or connect, or that it needs to stop now?
It's very quite simple that I absolutely know that one, that we're all one, and that there's, you know, that God loves through me, and that there's no lack of love. And so maybe I don't have money to give a beggar, but often I will just stop and acknowledge them and look them in the eye and bow to them. And sometimes I have the money to give them. Some of them I know, I've gotten to know, and I'll stop and talk to them. Or some are strangers, and I'll talk and ask, you know, how they ended up in this situation, and it just acknowledge them. And I want them to know that I see them.
Hmm.
Because they're me. I mean, they're all of us. They're part of us. And I grew up in poverty. And yet my mom always made us believe that we had everything. So even though we had nothing, I thought I had everything. And just to
and
be
you
able
did.
And I did. I mean, because what do we ultimately need? You know, we need to be part of a community and loved, and there's no lack of that. We can tap into that always.
Yeah. Can you describe your childhood a bit? I mean, it was amazing to read. I loved how you said you grew up in Buckingham Palace. as one of three children with a 1-year-old single mother in Buckingham Palace apartments.
I know, but, and I just thought that I lived at Buckingham Palace, so I just like in my, you know, we lived in a 2-bedroom apartment, all 3 kids in 1 room, which we loved, and all the animals that were there, the cardinal birds and the robins, and I just pretended like they were all part of the grounds, you know, that I had to care for. So I would take food out to the animals, and I would meet with anybody and everybody. And I remember there was a man that was alone, and he would feed the squirrels, and all the children were like afraid of him but me. And I would go just sit on the bench and learn how to feed the squirrels, and he, in my mind, was the caretaker for the animals. So I just had this whole thing I made up. And I lived in Buckingham Palace. And this was my, you know, this, all of it was the grounds and all the apartments and the stream and the trees. And it was expansive. I know. It's like my mom was that person, if you ever saw the movie Life is Beautiful, and they were in a concentration camp. And then kind of made it up that they were like in a play in a way. That's how my mother was. I mean, we had, like, we would get a cardboard box and just think, oh, my God, look at all the things we can do with this. We can make a house. We can make it into a train. It was just never a lack. I never felt a lack of anything.
Well, you sure completely embody interconnectedness, Arlene. I mean, all your words, everything. I mean, it's, I can just feel it with you. Really,
yeah.
Beautiful.
It mixed in all of that. I mean, I did have, you know, PTSD, and there were times that I have had so much heartache, and still sometimes I feel so sad, you know, that things have changed in Tibet and that I can't go back, but also for the freedom that they have lost. And I cry. I mean, it's not every day I wake up and think, oh my gosh, you know, I lived such a blessed life, which I do. I also feel the suffering for those people in France and what's happening with ISIS. And I really try consciously to remember that that's all of us too, that pain, that suffering, that loss, that hatred, it's just a thought away, you know, and it's all up to us to embody love, because that's the only thing that will transform our planet. We have to be fearless.
What gives you that ability to be fearless?
My faith. My connection with the God I am inside of me. Whether it's the Buddha nature or God or that life force. And
are you
a
meditator?
Pardon?
Are you a meditator?
I am. I mean, I certainly could meditate far more than I do, but yes, I do meditate. But it was funny, a girlfriend asked me yesterday, like, how much time do you spend practicing? And I said, every single moment of my life, every breath I take. All of it.
You can hear it in your stories too, how in a way your grounding practices influence you in your work. We do have one question in the queue, but I'm just curious, before we get to that, can you describe maybe how you came to see the world from that perspective, from that kind of spiritual perspective, or what, you know, what, how does spirituality influence you in your work, and how did, like, you just carry kind of such a strong conviction in it. What is your spiritual practice?
Well, I was raised Christian, and I was raised with a mother that absolutely, under all circumstances, no matter what, has believed that things were always, you know, in divine order. And when I was very young, I studied Eastern philosophy and Buddhism, and I just knew that, you know, for me, I didn't understand truly Buddha nature at that time as a teenager, but it just seems to be, I think, part of who I am. I can't remember a time when I wasn't connected to it, even as a child. I just remember always being connected to a higher force. And I remember once when I was quite young, that I maybe was about 10, that I had this sense that I had a conversation with Jesus, and just was like, knowing that I had no fear of death. I never did. I never had a fear of dying. But I just always have felt very protected, and even more and more in my life, knowing that when I am anxious or that when I'm fearful, that those are the moments that I feel separate from my spiritual practice, the God that I am, the Buddha that I am. When I forget that, that's when I lose who I am. And so I make it, it's really important to me to stay connected to that. Mm-hmm. And I do that through acts of service, through acts of compassion. That keeps me connected.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We'll go to our next question.
Hi, Arlene. Thank you for your wonderful story and your lifelong work. I read in your bio that you've been working with this model called Network of Safety model that you've used with 60,000 women across the world in Nepal and Mexico and other places as well. I was wondering if you could describe a little bit of that Network of Safety model. It seems like, given your life's organizing principles, it seems like that would be a very different model than what someone in a think tank might come up with.
Yeah, I'm happy that you asked that question, and it very much was taught to us, I think, by the work that we did culturally in Tibet, like realizing that to drive systemic behavior change, that everything, like a spokes to a tire, all have to be connected and work in tandem with each other. And so being able to read a lot about public health, a lot of times organizations go in and they address one component, like making sure there's a birthing center or trying to drive change at the government level, like new policies. But what I realized was that, first of all, we put the mom at the center, and she needs to understand what happens in pregnancy, why it's important, what are the danger signs, and why, if those things happen, that she needs to get care sooner than later. Then we teach that to the family so that the family can support her and holding her in that, you know, she gets the care that she needs, and that if there is a problem, that they will be available to assist her. And then we teach the whole community. So like if you're my neighbor and you notice something's going on, that you also know what to do. And then the ripple effect just goes out further to, okay, well, if we do that, then we need to train all the community health workers so that they know what to do and they have what they need to provide the care for her. And then there is a birthing center. And then if there's a problem beyond that we need to train people at the hospitals and make sure they have the equipment that they need. And then we also have to drive change at the government level when there's new advances in medicine that are easy to incorporate into the medical healthcare infrastructure, that we are bringing those new technologies to the government of Nepal to get approval, and then they decide that it gets incorporated into the system. So we never create a parallel healthcare system, but we work within the structure. So it's a very in-depth, holistic approach where if at any given time within the system that it breaks down, and we hear there's a maternal death, then we go back out and we do what's called a verbal autopsy, and we go trace the steps backwards, like what happened prior to this. You know, she had these symptoms, or this happened, or she didn't get care in time. So we can always constantly adjust the system. And if there is new technology, we can add it into an already functioning live network, so to speak. And this network of safety really is a web around not only the pregnant woman, but her family, her children, her community. It just keeps going, because all of it actually needs to work in tandem for lives to be saved. So we never thought, okay, well, if you do an intervention at that level, that's going to change lives. No, it all has to work together.
And I would imagine that even after the birthing process, that the web would probably still be there, because you've created it and it's reliant on so many social interactions that it would continue to sustain itself?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Have you written about this in depth, or is it just something that evolves organically in each of the places you work in?
The model we've written about in depth, I mean, not so much in like that it's been published, and it has been published in a few articles, in the sense that we talk about that every life is important, so the N of one, and high touch meets high tech.
Nice.
But not the network of safety as an independent, you know, article. But we do have a lot of it written up. But our bigger belief is that it's the high touch, that meeting high tech, that saves lives. That not just technology is going to save lives. You have to have people, a foundation, and then you can add to the foundation.
That's beautiful. Thank you. I look forward to finding that those articles online.
Yeah, if you go to our website under media, we have the most of the articles, or you can Google my name, Arlene Saman, or Sienna Craig, and they're co-authors with me on these articles.
Beautiful, beautiful. Mm-hmm. And just wanted to say thank you for all that you are and you represent. It's a really inspiring journey.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my honor.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll be sure to find some of those articles and share them with the folks on this call. Amita, feel free to jump in if you have any questions. But I think one thing I'm curious of when you shared the story about, being held at gunpoint, I was curious, you said that, you know, there's this young man who was just this young soldier who was caught off guard, and how he just kind of took the gun down and apologized. And
I know,
I felt
right?
I felt like that left me hanging. I mean, like, what exactly made him take down his gun and apologize? I don't know if there was anything in that moment. I mean, it must have been such a micro moment for you too, but if there's anything more in there.
I think that actually looking him in the eye and, you know, that human contact, like, I see you, you know, and you see me, and we're not different. And I saw one time on YouTube or something where I think she was an either Israeli or Palestinian woman, and soldiers were shooting with tanks and into the opposing neighborhood, and she actually went out and stood in front of the tanks and the soldiers and said, "Stop." And they did. You know, and I think that's what it will come down to, is like at some point in time, you know, we just, this collective consciousness says stop.
Yeah. That's powerful. In a way, I mean, it sounded like I'm reminded of this other woman who was on the call, on this awakening call maybe a month or so ago. Her name's Anne Sieben, and she is just a lifelong pilgrim in a way, and she's walked in some really challenging areas. And she said that there is one place where she was kind of walking through the desert, and these, like, a bunch of, you know, soldiers with young soldiers. She was like, they're young enough to be my children. they all yes. you know, were armed with guns, and it was basically a bunch of these soldiers aiming a gun at this, you know, white-haired, you know, like, harmless woman walking on a pilgrimage. And she said that just because she, in a way, she saw them as if they were her own sons,
right.
you know, by the end of the interaction, they were actually sending her prayers to bring to the pilgrimage site that she was going to.
Right, right, right. Well, I think we all have that within us.
Mm, yeah.
Instead of seeing other as enemy, that we see them as ourselves. Or our children, our neighbors.
Right.
When you connect soul to soul.
Soul to soul, yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, our world is falling apart, it seems, with all these terrorist acts lately.
I
don't think the answer is, you know, that to hate all Muslims, you know, that's not the way to go, you know. They're suffering. It's not them. It's just human beings. It has nothing to do with what religion we're born into. It's human nature making a choice to do something out of fear instead of love.
Mm. Yeah.
And unfortunately, our media tends to amplify the fear instead of
emphasize. Oh, yeah.
Love, all they do is amplify the fear. And so people respond with fear and more violent.
Yeah, that's what I think. It's like, who, what conversation is out there? Let's have a conversation with ISIS. I haven't heard that one. Right?
Right.
You're right, yeah. I'm curious, you know, given the range of experiences that you've had and work that you've done in so many different places and kind of the state of the world, you know, as of late, what's on the horizon for you? Like, where do you feel like you want to focus your time and energy now? You know, you mentioned you're back in the States and, you know, doing things here, but...
I mean... I'll continue to work with One Heart, but I'm also studying right now to work with patients with post-traumatic stress and end-of-life care. And I know people say, what are you going to do in your retirement? Like people just go, well, that doesn't sound like something, you know, that you want to do in your retirement, but I'm very motivated to continue my path of reducing suffering in our world, and that's another one where I have a lot of compassion.
Hmm. Was it
especially
go ahead.
No, I was going to say especially with our soldiers that come back. You know, and they've witnessed so much violence and have committed violence. And,
right.
Yeah.
Have you gotten to kind of work or interact directly with some of those soldiers?
Not yet. I'm early in my course, and right now we're watching a lot of videos of teachers working with PTSD soldiers.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious for you, how is it for you to kind of come back to the U.S., you know, I'm sure, I mean, many times, but between your travels from being in, you know, a rioting area or war-torn area and to come back into, you know, maybe some safety or comforts of that you might have here?
I'm incredibly grateful and also sometimes very sad in a way that, I mean, having to navigate my feelings of knowing that I've left behind people that are suffering. So like after the earthquake, I came home, but my staff and the villages, they were there without anything. And so sometimes I struggle with how best to deal with my own emotions around that and realizing, you know, that what I'm doing here will serve them greater than me being there. I'm feeling sorry for them. But it haunts me sometimes to think about that I have the freedom that I can come to a place where I feel safe. And that I have everything, you know, a roof over my head and food and everything else, and that I'm leaving behind people that don't have that. So I struggle with that.
Yeah.
I want everybody to have everything.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would produce a lot of conflicting emotions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I know we're kind of rounding out to the last few minutes of our call. Amita, do you have any kind of last thoughts or any last questions or burning thoughts?
No, it's just amazing to hear someone, you know, live, you know, their passion and live through service like you have done. It's a very inspiring story. I mean, you live from your heart and you live from love without fear. And that's, you know, what we all try to achieve. And it's inspiring to know how some people actually can do it. So it gives us, the rest of us, a model on how to kind of move forward as well.
Well, and the secret to all of it is the wind beneath my wings, which are my friends. It's the love that of my friends and my community that hold me up, and they hold me in all of this trials and tribulations and challenges, and with so much love that it just fills me back up, and so I have to really say that it's community that, and my faith, that's what holds me together and feeds me and nourishes me. And some of my community is on the phone right now, so they know who they are.
Well, now we're part of your community, too.
You're all part of my community. Yes.
Yes. And we're actually, you know, we'd love to know, I mean, is there any way, or how can our ecosystem be of service or support you and your beautiful intentions and work in the world?
Well, just today, this phone call, I mean, I can feel all of your love and support, and it comes back to me, and then it just goes back out to, you know, to feed this beautiful universe. And what I ask right now is that we hold, you know, all those that are suffering in Turkey and Syria and France and all over, that, you know, our prayers and our love reaches all of them today and every day.
Beautiful. Thank you. We'll finish our call. We're at the 90-minute mark, so we'll just close the call with a minute of silence and gratitude. And really want to thank you, Arlene, so much for just the gift of coming on this call and sharing your incredible experiences with us, whether it's with a cardboard box in Buckingham Palace apartment as a young kid, or, you know, being in these riots and still, or picking up, you know, just children off the streets and treating them as if they're your own daughter. It's so inspiring, and it definitely strengthens my resolve to kind of be of service in whatever ways I can. So thank you so much for joining us today. And on the count of three, we'll all do a thank you, a group thank you to Arlene. 1, 2, 3. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Happy weekend.
Thank you, guys. Keep up the good work.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.